Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the November 25th, 2022 issue of the Week. The cover drawing this week is the wrestling rink. Looks like a professional wrestling scene. Standing in the center of the ring is Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. He's got on a red onesie with the symbol of the state of Florida in the middle. He's flexing a bicep and looking at the crowd. But jumping off the corner post is Donald Trump, and he's also got a wrestling outfit that says MAGA in the middle of it, and he's pouncing to land on top of DeSantis. In the background, the referee is House Majority Leader now, Kevin McCarthy, or maybe Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy. He's in the referee outfit, and he looks kind of exasperated. The headline is, No Holds Barred. Can DeSantis survive a 2024 smackdown with Trump? That is one of our main stories, and we will start there. Little Republican support for Trump's 2024 bid. What happened? Donald Trump declared this week he was running for president in 2024, saying the country was being destroyed and the southern border invaded. In a meandering hour-long speech to about 600 supporters at Mar-a-Lago, the twice-impeached former president painted American cities as cesspools of violent crime and himself as a victim of federal investigators. Trump, 76, is facing several criminal investigations into his actions during the January 6th insurrection, his instruction to Georgian officials to find enough votes to swing the state to him, and his possession of classified documents. And friends and aides anonymously told the New York Times that he is hoping that formally declaring his candidacy might stall or prevent the filing of charges. In his speech, Trump cast himself as an outsider. The Washington establishment wants to silence us, he said. We won't let them. Republicans greeted Trump's announcement without much enthusiasm. Many one-time allies blamed him for the GOP underperformance in the midterms, pointing out the candidates he had endorsed trailed other Republican candidates by an average of 5 percentage points. Rupert Murdoch, whose media empire includes Fox News, The Wall Street Journal, and The New York Post, reportedly told Trump that he would not support a third presidential run. Some conservative outlets indicated their preferred candidate was Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who hasn't yet declared his 2024 intentions. A Post cover last week nicknamed him "The Future." Trump warned the governor not to run, saying he could hurt himself very badly and hinting at skeletons in his closet. But DeSantis, who cruised to re-election with a victory margin of nearly 20 points, shrugged off Trump's criticism. "I would just tell people to go check out the scoreboard," he said. What the editorial said. "No," said National Review. "That is our firm, unmistakable answer to the prospect of another Trump candidacy. As president, Trump achieved many long-held Republican goals. He delivered tax cuts, pushed deregulation, appointed 3 conservative judges to the Supreme Court, and pursued tough border policies. But we can't forget his shameful attempt to overturn the results of the 2020 election, nor that his railing about election fraud has emboldened conspiracy theorists and fanatics. Republicans should find someone who is not monumentally selfish or morally and electorally compromised." Trump is unfit for public office, said the New York Times, and his second term would be a revenge tour of grievances and political payback unchecked by traditional Democratic guardrails. He would almost certainly resume his corrupt self-dealing and fill his administration with sycophants who could baselessly dispute election results or even use the powers of the executive to persecute opponents. If he's on the ballot in 2024, the election will once again be a referendum on American democracy. What the columnist said. Trump had to run, said Dennis Aftergut in the Bulwark, because he's scared witless at the possibility of prosecution. Indictments from Fulton County, Georgia, over the interference in the state's vote count, and from the Justice Department over the Mar-a-Lago documents, appear to be on their way. And the DOJ is examining whether to charge him in connection with its January 6 investigation. Now that he's declared, Trump can shriek that the indictment of a presidential candidate would be unprecedented, but that won't deter prosecutors. Republicans are realizing that Trump is a loser, said Hugo Gurdon in the Washington Examiner. In 2018, he lost the midterms. In 2020, he lost his bid for re-election. And last week, he helped Democrats avoid the blowout defeat they richly deserved. His unusually early declaration is the defensive and nervous act of a candidate trailing his rivals. DeSantis has outpolled him by double digits in Iowa, Georgia, Texas, and other states. Republicans now support their party over Trump by 62% to 30%. That still leaves Trump diehards making up a third of the party, said George Conway in the Washington Post. With such a base, he can only be bested for the GOP nomination in a contest that's one-on-one from the outset. Could the party coalesce behind DeSantis? We don't know yet. At just 44, the governor may be inclined to avoid tangling with Trump and his cult of personality now and instead make a run after his gubernatorial term ends in 2026. If he does, the alternatives for Republicans are ugly. Another national defeat led by Trump, or intra-party civil war. The controversy of the week is Biden. Should he run in 2024 or step aside? The midterms were very good to President Biden, said Frank Bruni in the New York Times. But even the Democrats' surprisingly strong performance can't turn back the hands of time. Already the oldest president in U.S. history, Biden turns 80 on November 20th, and his age is weighing heavily on Democratic minds. Biden doesn't project anything like the ebullience he once did. And while he's gaffe-prone, he's been suffering more verbal slip-ups than transcend malapropisms. Discussing his program of student loan relief, for example, he recently told reporters it passed Congress by a vote or two, when, of course, he decreed it by executive order. Biden will be nearly 82 on Election Day, said Norman Solomon in Salon. His net approval rating is minus 12, and 68% of voters told exit pollsters last week they don't want him to run again. Biden is now a drag on his party, and Democrats should pressure him to step aside. Don't count on it, said Audrey Fahlberg in the Dispatch. In fact, the 2024 nomination is now Biden's if he wants it. He's had two extremely productive years of passing bipartisan legislation, with millions of jobs created, and a vaccination campaign that tamed the pandemic. Couple that with the absence of a midterm Republican red wave, and a Biden re-election announcement may clear the field entirely. It's not as if the Democrats have an obvious successor, said Peter Baker in the New York Times. Vice President Kamala Harris is even less popular than Biden, and as the president likes to remind anyone who will listen, he remains the only Democrat who has ever beaten Donald Trump. The prospect of a MAGA return may terrify Democrats into sticking with Biden over a fresher face from their unproven bench. Nobody's scared of Trump anymore, said Michael Hopkins in the Daily Beast. The midterms showed that Trump is more beatable than ever, and that Democrats have a deep bench of viable presidential candidates. Serious consideration should be given to three young, charismatic governors: Michigan's Gretchen Whitmer, Maryland's Wes Moore, and Pennsylvania's Josh Shapiro, whose victories last week were just as impressive as Republican Ron DeSantis' win in Florida. California Governor Gavin Newsom and Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg are also options. With some polls suggesting the vigorous 44-year-old DeSantis could beat Trump for the GOP nomination, it would be suicidal for Democrats to nominate the doddering Biden. For the sake of his party and the nation, it's time for Joe to pass the torch. What's the hurry? Asked Jackie Calmes in the Los Angeles Times. With Trump and DeSantis at war, Republicans are now entering a period of intra-party bloodletting. So why should Democrats rush into their own civil war when they can sit back, let their bench get more experience, and see how the landscape looks next year? Like most progressives, I was skeptical of Biden's candidacy in 2020, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer. With hindsight, though, it's hard to see who else could have assembled the coalition of black voters, young people, suburbanites, and moderates that proved just enough to rescue America from a second Trump term. Trump himself may be fading, but the authoritarian right is alive and well. As long as Biden feels he can still lead his party, it would be nothing short of reckless to entrust the nation's fate to anyone else. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for lessons learned. After Ivanka Trump declined to attend her father's presidential campaign announcement and told him she's done with politics. "This time around," said Ivanka, "I am choosing to prioritize my young children." It was a good week for commitment after actor Rainn Wilson announced that he is changing his name to Rainfall Heatwave Extreme Winter Wilson to highlight the dangers of climate change. "This is not a joke," said Wilson, 56. "I'm as serious as the melting Arctic." It was a good week for having company. As the human population passed 8 billion, just 12 years after it passed 7 billion, the United Nations projects it will take until 2037 to reach 9 billion. But it was a bad week for KFC, which invited customers in Germany to commemorate the anniversary of Kristallnacht, the 1938 night of anti-Jewish attacks, by choosing to treat yourself with more tender cheese on your crispy chicken. The company quickly apologized. It was a bad week for the peasantry after a British court banned Patrick Thelwell, 23, from carrying eggs in public after he was arrested for throwing eggs at King Charles. "I did what I did because I don't believe in kings," said Thelwell. And it was a bad week for smuggling after TSA agents in Fort Lauderdale discovered a raw chicken inside a passenger's checked luggage and a loaded handgun inside the chicken. The agency said that stuffing a firearm in your holiday bird for travel is just a waste of time. The title of the briefing this week is Debating COVID's Origins. Republicans have issued a new report on the lab leak theory and promise hearings. What does the evidence show? What is the lab leak theory? There are two competing theories about how SARS-CoV-2, the cause of the COVID pandemic, emerged in Wuhan, China in December 2019. Most virologists believe it originated in bats and crossed over from an intermediate animal to humans at a Wuhan wet market, where wild animals were sold for food. This would be consistent with how previous zoonotic viruses have crossed over from animals to humans, including two other coronaviruses. SARS, believed to have come from bats through civets, and MERS, from camels. HIV is traced to chimpanzees, and the 1918 Spanish flu is believed to have originated in domestic or wild birds. An alternate origin theory for SARS-CoV-2 is that it was created at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, where scientists were studying bat coronaviruses. That theory, which posits that the virus infected someone from the lab, who then spread it in Wuhan. A World Health Organization investigative team that traveled to China in early 2021 deemed a lab leak extremely unlikely, but many experts felt their investigation was insufficiently rigorous, and congressional Republicans have lined up behind the lab leak theory. Senate Republicans recently issued an interim report signed by Senator Richard Burr, the Republican from North Carolina, asserting that the pandemic was most likely the result of a research-related incident. What is the evidence for a lab leak? It's all circumstantial. Lab leak theorists point to the Chinese government's obstruction of investigations into COVID's origins and the lab's activities. They cite a U.S. intelligence report that several lab workers were hospitalized with a COVID-like illness in November 2019. Some scientists say the virus' extraordinary infectiousness among humans suggests it underwent gain-of-function alteration in a lab. A virus that comes out of a bat cave and infects humans by the millions is not biologically plausible, wrote former CDC Director Robert Redfield in the Wall Street Journal. Burr and others also cite the fact that virologists have been unable to find a wild animal that carries the SARS-CoV-2 virus, though similar viruses are found in bats. Many virologists dismiss the Barr report as a load of anti-science crap, in the words of Peter Hotez, dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine. They say the evidence for zoonotic spillover is far stronger. What is that evidence? In a study published in July in the journal Science, a team of 18 scientists said detailed analysis of early COVID cases definitively shows the Wuhan wet market was the pandemic's epicenter. By studying viruses found at the market, maps of market stalls, social media activity of early COVID cases in Wuhan, and other data, the scientists determined that all the early cases involved vendors and people who shopped there. The next concentric ring of cases affected people who lived or worked nearby. Given the extraordinary clustering around the market, it's just not plausible that this virus was introduced any other way than through wildlife trade, said co-author Michael Worabi, an evolutionary biologist at the University of Arizona. Swabs taken by Chinese health officials at the market tested positive for the virus, especially where live animals such as hedgehogs, minks, and bamboo rats were stacked in cages, creating ideal conditions for disease spillover. A second paper published in Science cited evidence that two distinct lineages of the virus were present at the market, suggesting separate spillovers. China destroyed the animals, preventing testing. But the vast majority of human viruses, including all human coronaviruses, have zoonotic origins, said a 2021 paper by 21 virologists published in Cell, which cites no evidence that SARS-CoV-2 has a laboratory origin. Does that end the debate? No. As with many matters related to COVID, the origin debate is enmeshed in a red-blue rift, with many Republicans and some scientists lining up behind the lab leak theory. Democrats argue that the Trump administration and its supporters seized on the lab leak theory early in the pandemic to shift blame away from President Trump's chaotic response into China. Republicans also point a finger of blame at White House infectious disease advisor Anthony Fauci, charging that he dismissed evidence of a lab leak because it implicated his institute, which funded viral research at the Wuhan lab. House Republicans have vowed to hold hearings on the lab leak theory. How do we learn the truth? We probably never will with 100% certainty. There is no smoking gun one way or the other, and we may never get it, said Temple University virologist Sergi Pond. Many scientists warn that the ongoing partisan debate diverts attention and resources away from detecting and preparing for the emergence of other zoonotic viruses that could cause new pandemics. If we focused on the wrong problem, said Stuart Neal, a virologist at King's College in London, we run the risk of letting this happen again. Moving into the best columns of the week, the first two come from the U.S., starting with a brighter pandemic picture. Though it makes sense to stay vigilant, the worst fears about a fall COVID wave so far haven't materialized, said the Washington Post. The long dominant BA5 Omicron subvariant has recently been supplanted by a mix of several worrisome new variants, such as BQ11 and its offshoots, which now make up about 44% of new infections. Despite concerns that these variants would evade prior immunity, hospitalizations and deaths have remained stable, even in New York, the state with the highest current level of BQ11 infections. The pandemic might be reaching a stage where infections still spread, but people are protected by a growing wall of immunity. It's also possible the virus is evolving to be more infectious but less lethal than the Delta and first Omicron variants. Beware of complacency, however. COVID can still make you quite sick, with possible long-term consequences, so it is still a good idea to get boosted with the bivalent COVID shot, especially if you're over 65. It's also wise to mask in crowded public spaces, especially since we're seeing early signs of an intense season of respiratory illnesses, such as the flu and RSV. The pandemic has been a three-year-long lesson in always being ready for the unexpected. Democrat stars who keep losing. Rank-and-file Democrats keep donating millions to charismatic candidates Stacey Abrams and Beto O'Rourke, said Audrey Fahlberg. But these progressive darlings keep losing elections. Abrams raked in $85 million in contributions for her Georgia gubernatorial race, but was beaten by 7 percentage points by Governor Brian Kemp in a purple state, far worse than she did 4 years ago. O'Rourke, who keeps losing elections, also got a huge fundraising haul, but was blown out by Governor Greg Abbott by 11 points. So why have Democrats continued to prop up dead-end candidates like them? Blame the party's small donor fundraising culture. Democrats rely on online gimmicks like fundraising thermometers and countdown clocks that target Republicans whom progressives hate. These tactics generate a lot of $10 and $20 contributions, but also encourage donors to fixate on unwinnable races. In 2020, for example, donors gave $90 million to Amy McGrath, Senator Mitch McConnell's opponent in deep red Kentucky, and saw her lose by 20 points. Democrats also squandered tens of millions on Abrams and O'Rourke, rather than funding Democrats in close, winnable races across the country. Will small donors learn that lesson? Probably not. This column comes from South Korea. Nukes are bankrupting North Korea. North Korea is trying to flaunt its nukes to cover up dictator Kim Jong-un's failure, said Kim Byung-yeon. The rogue state recently fired at least 30 nuclear-capable missiles in a flamboyant display meant to convince the world that it must be treated as a nuclear weapons state. Its aim is to make South Korea and the U.S. give up attempts to push for denuclearization outright and instead settle for a bargain, a nuclear arms reduction deal in return for removal of crippling sanctions. Don't be fooled. In reality, Kim's military displays come from a place of weakness. North Korea's economy is tiny, far less than 1% of South Korea's, and it has been steadily contracting ever since international sanctions were imposed in 2017 as a punishment for Kim's nuclear programs. Defectors who have managed to flee to South Korea say their families often went hungry, especially in winter. At some point, Kim will be forced to choose between his nuclear arsenal and the economy. So when Kim launches barrages of missiles, the U.S. and South Korea must not overreact in a panicky manner and conclude that North Korea can't be pressured out of its nukes. These displays merely represent the desperation of the despot as he runs out of time. The last word, our feature article, titled this week, The Troubles Unhealed Wounds. Almost 25 years after the Good Friday Agreement, the violent legacy of sectarian warfare still haunts Northern Ireland, said Caitlin Thompson in Coda Story. The peace remains tenuous. On January 3rd in 1976, two Catholic brothers, John Michael and Brian Reavy, and two Protestant brothers, Reggie and Walter Chapman, were playing pool at a pub in a small town in South Armagh, Northern Ireland. The men, all in their early 20s, had been friendly for years. They played soccer together. Amicable relations between Catholics and Protestants had become increasingly rare, even in a small rural town. The Reavy brothers went by fake names in the soccer league because they also played sports with the Gaelic Athletic Association, an Irish cultural group that prohibited its members from playing non-Gaelic sports until 1971. The troubles had been raging for several years in this area, south of Belfast, and a short distance from the border with the Republic of Ireland, had been especially hard hit. About 400 people in South Armagh were killed over 30 years, a higher death toll than in any other part of Northern Ireland aside from Belfast. It's hard to imagine the violence that plagued South Armagh during the sectarian conflict that lasted from the late 1960s until peace was brokered by the Clinton administration in 1998. Northern Ireland is still segregated. Only 7% of children go to schools attended by both Catholics and Protestants. In Belfast, gates and towering walls topped with barbed wire close every evening. The deep wounds left on society by the Troubles still fester, represented by neatly kept memorials on roadsides. If you know where to look, each turn in a narrow country road, each old farmhouse at the top of a rolling hill, tells the story of a dark moment in a traumatic history. On that night in January 1976, the Reavy brothers were having a drink at the local pub when they bumped into the Chapman brothers. At one point, a bomb rolled into the bar, but it failed to go off. So once the police and the army had removed the threat, the men carried on with their game of pool. Within 48 hours, all four of them were murdered. On the next day, on January 4th, John Michael and Brian Reavy were at their farmhouse watching the comedy game show Celebrity Square with their 17-year-old brother, Anthony. A gunman barged through the front door and opened fire. John Michael was nearly cut in two by a spray of bullets from a machine gun. Brian was shot in the back trying to get upstairs to hide. The bullet came out through his heart. Anthony hid under the bed, but the gunman found him and filled his abdomen with 17 bullets. Somehow, Anthony managed to drag himself up the street to a nearby farmhouse. When the neighbor saw the boy, she called for the ambulance, the police, and the priest. Anthony was making a miraculous recovery when he died suddenly 26 days later on January 30th in what the family maintains were suspicious circumstances. The murder was meticulously planned. Gunmen drove from a farmhouse a mile away. Army checkpoints at both ends of the roads ensured nobody saw them coming. After firing off the fatal rounds from a 9mm Luger pistol, a .455 Welby revolver, a 9mm Parabellum, and a Sterling submachine gun, the gunman sped away, switching cars, handing off the guns, and burning the vehicle they drove to the attack. It took 12 minutes. In pursuit of justice for the brothers, Eugene has taken investigators on this route several times in recent years. The gunmen traveled these roads with impunity. They were never going to be stopped, because it's all Protestant country here. So the police would have recognized all these people, and they just waved them on, Eugene said, pointing across the fields to the road where an officer would have been standing, shining a light to give the gunman the go-ahead. Nobody has ever been held accountable. Eugene has dedicated his life to changing that. It has put him on the front lines in a fight between survivors who want the truth and those who have something to lose from it coming out. Eugene Reavy, who was 28 in 1976, is now in his mid-70s. I want the truth if I can get it. Then I want justice. But there's no such thing, said Eugene. The small community was still reeling from the violence at the Reavies when tragedy struck again the next day. On January 5th, 1976, Walter and Reggie Chapman were on their way home from work at the Kings Mill plant when their bus stopped suddenly on a secluded country road. Armed men forced the brothers and 10 others off the bus. The gunman asked if there were any Catholics among them, and as one man went to step forward, the others pulled him back, thinking he was the target. The Catholic man was allowed to walk away. 11 Protestants, including Walter and Reggie, were shot in their tracks, left to die on the pavement. Only one man survived. The South Armagh Republican Action Force, found to be a cover name for the Provisional IRA, claimed responsibility for the fatal ambush. Many believed it was retaliation for the murders the day before of the Reavy brothers and members of another Catholic family, the O'Dowds, who lived about half an hour away. Everybody in Northern Ireland has their own version of what happened during the Troubles. The Good Friday Agreement ended the bloodshed, but it did not offer a way to grapple with the history of violence. No one was appointed to look into the killings. Later, there were attempts to create a framework to get at the truth of what happened and hold people accountable for their violence. All have failed. 4 days after the murder of his brothers, Eugene Reavy waited for the police to come talk to the family. But nobody did. I was expecting something. We got nothing, he told me. Decades went by, and the Reavy family tried their best to heal. Along the way, a picture started to form of a secretive murder squad in South Armagh operating in the 1970s. International investigators started to look into evidence that security forces in the army and police had colluded with loyalist paramilitaries. Known as the Glen Ann Gang, they were responsible for more than 120 murders. The murder of the Reavy brothers, as well as investigations into other events such as the 1971 torture by the British Army of 14 Catholics known as the Hooded Men, get at one of the most contentious features of the bloody conflict, the role security forces played during the Troubles. Were the army and police keeping the peace, protecting society from terrorists, or were they active participants? Being a policeman or a soldier in Northern Ireland was a dangerous job. In all, 1,441 members of the British Armed Forces, including 197 serving Ulster Defense Regiment soldiers, were killed during Operation Banner, the deployment that lasted from 1969 to 2007. Another 319 members of the Royal Ulster Constabulary were also killed. Many others still live with the scars, either physical or psychological. But there is a growing body of evidence that there was collusion between security forces and loyalist paramilitaries. Since the Good Friday Agreement, the police ombudsman, the watchdog body tasked with investigating police killings, has found that RUC officers protected members of the loyalist paramilitaries and turned a blind eye as these groups armed themselves with weapons later used in sectarian killings. Eugene Reavy was on his way to the hospital to pick up the bodies of his brothers, John Michael and Brian, on January 5, 1976, the day after their murder at the family's home. And I was coming up that hill. There was a fellow waving his arms frantically, Eugene told me as we retraced his steps one morning this May. I put the window down and he says, "Come up here quick. There's been an awful slaughter." Eugene got out of his car and started walking up the hill when he saw it. At first, he thought there had been an accident and a neighbor's cows were lying on the street. "There was steam rising out of these bodies, you know," he said. "It was raining." It was as if Eugene could see the bloodied street in his mind's eye, and he described the smell of death to me. It haunts me to this day, and such carnage. Almost immediately, the accusations started flying. None of the Reavies were involved in any paramilitary, but police told people the IRA shot the Reavy brothers because they wouldn't go along with the plot to kill security forces, or that Eugene was responsible for the murders at Kingsmill. Northern Ireland's failure to address its contested history has left room for what some historians call permissible lies. In the absence of truth, people fill in their own narratives. For Eugene, things got worse. For 4 days after his brother's death, police stopped him driving to work, pulled him out of his car and down into a field where they held him on his knees in the river at gunpoint. "And the water was up to there," he said, pointing to his chin. And the big guy takes out a gun and puts it to my head and he says, "Who shot the people at Kingsmill?" I say, "I don't effing know. You needn't be asking me. Who shot the people at Kingsmill?" And that went on 5 times. The rumor that Eugene Reavy was responsible for killing Walter and Reggie Chapman persisted for decades. 25 years later, he was driving home from work when he heard on the radio that the militant Protestant leader, Ian Paisley, was going to reveal the killers at Kingsmill on the floor of the House of Commons. Eugene didn't think much of it until he learned that Paisley had named him as the mastermind of the attack. I nearly died, and my wife, God help her, she was nuts. It was later proved, after lengthy legal battle and an investigation by the Historical Inquiries Team at the Police Service of Northern Ireland, that Eugene Reavy had nothing to do with the murders of Kingsmill. But the damage had been done. People I had known for years just turned their back, walked away. "Neighbors wouldn't speak to me," Eugene said, "because no matter where you went, see that man? That's the man who shot the people at Kingsmill." That went on for years and years and years. The area along the Shankill Road in North Belfast, just a few blocks from a peace wall gate that closes at 6 p.m., is unmistakably Protestant. You don't have to look hard before you spot the Red Hand of Ulster, red poppies, the Union Jack. On one corner, behind a black metal gate, there's a memorial that has a very different tone from the others that dot the city. It's not about tradition, history, or the bravery of those who fought on one side or another. It's just angry. On the walls, there are photos of young children with captions like, "Murdered by Sinn Féin IRA for being Protestant," or "Sinn Féin IRA's slaughter of the innocents." Violent images of carnage caused by bombings are intermixed with photos of IRA members who are now in government. I can't pull my eyes away from one block of photos of terror attacks in Paris in November 2015 and an IRA bombing in London. IRA, Sinn Féin, ISIS, no difference, reads the caption. The monument is graphic, inflammatory, but it's only one symbol of the embers of the troubles that are still burning today. In Derry, there are indications of the same anger coming from the opposite side. In one mural, two men wearing balaclavas point machine guns. "Unfinished revolution" is written across the top. Around the city, there are symbols of modern-day paramilitaries, like a sign for the fringe Republican group, Sarad, with the slogan, "Salute the women and men of violence." These memorials represent the margins. The vast majority in Northern Ireland support the Good Friday Agreement and do not want a return to violence. But these symbols contribute to an ever-present uneasiness in the air, a fear that peace is tenuous. Failing to grapple with the past has kept this anger alive. It's still raw. Every fifth person you stop on the road will know somebody who died, possibly a relative. "And that still hurts people," said Danny Morrison, a former Republican political prisoner and former Sinn Féin director of publicity. "We are, in a sense, captives of the dead." This was adapted from an article that originally appeared in Coda Story. Read one of the obituaries this week. The comedian who smashed watermelons, Gallagher, 1946-2022. Gallagher obliterated more than 15,000 watermelons during his 30 years in stand-up. The beret-wearing, mustached comedian played more than 100 shows a year, and everyone closed with him smashing a melon with a sledgehammer. The fans in the front seats, the area known as Death Row, knew that Gallagher's sledge-o-matic would splatter them. Many showed up with raincoats and umbrellas. But that was just the finale to a madcap, prop-centered act that earned him a dozen specials on Showtime. He said he always aimed to provide an absurdist escape from the stresses of daily life. "If you make fun of it, the people laugh," he said in 1984. "They release the tension and are somehow healed a bit." Born Leo Gallagher Jr. in North Carolina, the future comedian was nicknamed Butch as a child. When he was about 10, his family moved to Tampa, where his father owned a roller skating rink, and he soon became a regional skating champion. Gallagher developed a talent for speed and freestyle skating that he later incorporated into a stage act, racing around on roller skates with a balloon tail, said the Washington Post. On his final day of high school, he was expelled for insubordination, but a counselor intervened, and he was allowed to graduate and attend the University of South Florida, where he studied chemistry and literature. After college, he worked odd jobs while pursuing comedy, appearing on The Tonight Show in 1975, and releasing his first Showtime special in 1980. "It was a slow but steady rise," said the New York Times, and he eventually became one of the most recognizable comedians of the 1980s. Gallagher's humor was based on wordplay and shock value, said the Los Angeles Times. But toward the end of his career, his political jokes fell flat, and he was criticized for making racist, sexist, and homophobic remarks on stage. In 2011, he stormed out of an interview for comedian Mark Maron's popular WTF podcast after Maron pressed him on his penchant for punching down. But even if he sometimes missed the mark, Gallagher always aspired to go beyond just earning a cheap laugh. "You can get a laugh just by sticking your finger in your nose," he said. "I want to do more. I want to say something to feed the brain." And we'll follow that with a technology article. FTX, a crypto empire, swiftly implodes. The opaque world of cryptocurrency investing has seen large financial losses before, but nothing has ever hit the industry like the spectacular collapse of FTX, said Felix Salmon in Axios. FTX founder Sam Bankman-Fried was the face of crypto, an MIT grad wunderkind who charmed the blue-chip investors into pouring $1.8 billion into his now-bankrupt crypto exchange, which had celebrities like Tom Brady, Stephen Curry, and Larry David appearing in its ads. Now SFB, or SBF as he's known, looks like a crook who is embezzling his own customers' funds to finance risky investments by the hedge fund he also controlled, Alameda Research. SBF's stated dream, and that of most other crypto entrepreneurs, was for the industry to improve upon and supplant the world's existing financial infrastructure. In fact, behind the scenes, it was engaging in much the same grift and leveraged risk-taking that preceded the 2008 financial crisis. Just weeks ago, Bankman-Fried was considered crypto's version of John Pierpont Morgan, said Tom Maloney in Bloomberg, because of how he had stepped in to rescue other companies facing imminent collapse this spring. The curly-haired 30-year-old, known for wearing shorts and T-shirts, was worth about $16 billion, thanks to his majority stakes in FTX and Alameda, and a 7.6% stake in the online trading platform Robinhood. After his resignation from FTX last week, Bankman-Fried suffered a staggering 94% wealth wipeout. It's a huge loss for Democrats, as Bankman-Fried was also a major donor toward progressive causes. The Bahamas-based exchange and its founder could be facing serious criminal liability, said Dave Michaels in the Wall Street Journal. The Manhattan U.S. Attorney's Office has begun investigating the reports about the lending of customers' funds to Alameda. As much as $10 billion from FTX accounts may have been used to prop up the hedge fund. There are no customer protection laws in crypto, but using customer funds for a purpose that wasn't disclosed can constitute fraud or embezzlement. The meltdown we're seeing now could have been even worse, said Annie Lowry in The Atlantic. Wall Street has been desperate to pour money into crypto, but it is precisely because regulators in the U.S. and other countries understood crypto's risks that traditional financial institutions were walled off from the current meltdown. Without that, we'd have another 2008-scale financial crisis. Instead, most of the damage is being borne by small-scale investors. These investors blindly put their trust in a panoply of intermediaries who behaved like traditional banks and brokers without the regulations to protect their customers, said Bloomberg in an editorial. FTX appeared to be among the best run of these intermediaries. It's clear now that none are worthy of your trust. And we're on the Talking Points page. start with the article, Kherson, a game-changing win for Ukraine. When Ukrainian forces raised their flag in Kherson last week and jubilant residents celebrated in the streets, said Robin Dixon and Catherine Belton in the Washington Post. Russian dictator Vladimir Putin suffered his most consequential political and military defeat yet. Facing the possibility of encirclement by the advancing Ukrainian army, Russian forces withdrew from the illegally annexed regional capital, the biggest city they had captured since the war began in February. Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu and General Sergei Surovikin insisted in an awkward robotic state TV interview that the pullback was more a strategic maneuver to prevent more Russian troop deaths. So far, more than 100,000 have already been killed or wounded. But the fall of Kherson was a huge blow for Putin. And on a daring visit to the liberated city this week, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky called this victory the beginning of the end of the war. That might be overstating it, said Zishan Alim in MSNBC.com. Russian troops are regrouping just south of Kherson across the Dnipro River, and some could be redeployed to defend occupied territory in the Donbas. Still, Ukrainian forces are scoring one unlikely victory after another, and reclaiming Kherson makes citizens and soldiers believe that bigger victories are possible. In desperation, Moscow has fallen back on traditional Russian military strategy, said Garrett Campbell in The Hill. The Russians are digging World War I-style trenches, relentlessly destroying civilian infrastructure with missile attacks, and with winter coming, trying to grind down Ukrainian forces and the citizenry. It's time for the West to give the Ukrainians combat drones, modern aircraft, longer-range missiles, and the other arms they need to build on their gains. After the Kherson humiliation, Russia has been signaling openness to precondition-free negotiations for peace, said Kathy Young in The Bulwark. U.S. Army General Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, has called this window of opportunity for Ukraine to bargain from a position of strength. But Russia's sham referenda and annexations of occupied territory have made any peace talks effectively impossible. Ukrainians will never forfeit 20% of their country to the regime that has tortured, raped, abducted, and killed tens of thousands of their citizens. The West must enable them to either win militarily or negotiate on their own terms. Election deniers, a resounding defeat. The stakes could not have been higher, said Charlotte Alter in Time. In last week's midterms, a host of Republican candidates who trumpeted Donald Trump's big lie that the 2020 election was stolen were seeking offices that would have put them in a position to oversee elections and sow chaos in swing states in 2024. But nearly all of them lost. Losers included Mark Fincham, candidate for Arizona Secretary of State, who marched at the Capitol on January 6 and said it was fantasy that Biden had won Arizona in 2020. In Nevada, MAGA conspiracy theorist Jim Marchant, who claimed state election winners were chosen by a deep state cabal, lost his Secretary of State race to Democrat Cisco Aguilar. All told, according to the nonpartisan group States United Action, 94 election deniers ran for offices that oversee elections, and only 14 won. Election deniers also lost big in gubernatorial races, said Jeremy Stahl in Slate. In Wisconsin, Republican Tim Mitchells, who vowed that if he won, Republicans would never lose another election in Wisconsin, lost to Democrat Tony Evers. In Arizona and Pennsylvania, voters balked at giving Trump back deniers Kerry Lake and Doug Mastriano power over the state's future election. It turns out that securing democracy did resonate with voters. That means a controversial and risky strategy by Democrats paid off, said Laura Washington in the Chicago Tribune. In 13 races, Dems spent more than $36 million to promote election-denying MAGA candidates over more moderate Republicans, betting they'd lose in November. Six won their primaries, and last week, all six lost. Election deniers are down, but not yet out, said Bill Loiters in the Bulwark. At least 150 won or were projected to win House races, including two who marched on the Capitol on January 6. Election deniers J.D. Vance and Rand Paul won Senate races in Ohio and Kentucky, while Alabama Governor Kay Ivey, who ran ads saying blue state liberals stole the election from Trump, coasted to re-election. Still, there are signs the hornet of the election denialism just might be losing its sting, said Austin Surratt and Dennis Aftergut in The Hill. Lake, who called her narrow loss BS, may yet prove to be a prominent exception, but it's remarkable that nearly all Republican losers have yet to cry fraud. Their concession speeches were the sounds of democracy, and it was good to hear them. And we'll finish today's show with a quote from author James Baldwin, quoted in the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. History is literally present in all that we do. It is to history that we owe our frame of reference and identities and our aspirations. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you have enjoyed it. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call. 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.